On one very cold and very cloudy Saturday morning, January 15th, 1929, just 3 months after the beginning of the worst economic depression in the history of the United States, Alberta Williams King and her husband, the Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., gave birth to their first child. They named him Martin after his father, and he would grow up to make it one of the most famous names in all of American history. Little Martin Luther King Jr. would, in his lifetime, change the way people understood democracy, religion, race relations, and human relations throughout the entire world. Young Martin grew up in a relatively middle-class home, but in a very segregated Atlanta, Georgia. Though he never wanted for food or clothing, he knew that whenever he walked out the door into white America, he would always be considered colored and therefore always second class. He could not buy a Coke or a hamburger at any downtown stores. He could not sit at a lunch counter. He could not drink water at the whites-only water fountains. He could not use the whites-only restrooms, and he could not ride on the whites-only elevators. If he went to a theater, he would have to enter from the colored entrance. If he rode a bus, he would have to sit in the back in the colored seats. And if he wanted to go swimming, golfing, or play tennis, he simply couldn't, because all of the pools, courses, or courts had whites-only signs in front of them. Here are some of his own reflections on what it was like to grow up in a segregated world.
Growing up a Negro in America is not a comfortable existence. It means being a part of the company of the bruised, the battered, the scarred, and the defeated. Being a Negro in America means trying to smile when you want to cry. It means trying to hold on to physical life amid psychological death. It means the pain of watching your own children grow up with clouds of inferiority in their mental skies. It means having their legs cut off and then being condemned for being a cripple. It means seeing your mother and father spiritually murdered by the slings and arrows of daily exploitation and then being hated for being an orphan. Being a Negro in America means listening to suburban politicians talk eloquently against open housing while arguing in the same breath that they are not racists. It means being harried by day and haunted by night by a nagging sense of nobodiness and constantly fighting to be saved from the poison of bitterness. It means the ache and anguish of living in so many situations where hopes unborn have died.
When he graduated from high school, he went to Morehouse College in Atlanta, then Crozier Seminary in Pennsylvania. There he made straight A's and received a scholarship to go on to graduate school. He chose Boston University School of Theology, where he again made straight A's and received a PhD in theology. He married his wife June 18, 1953. 6 months later, in January of 1954, King was invited to come to Montgomery, Alabama, to interview for pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. What would become his first full-time pastorate? And on April 14th, he accepted the call to the church. On December 1st, he was making plans for a series of sermons on the coming of the Christ child at Christmas. A black seamstress in Montgomery named Rosa Parks, after a long day at work, refused to give up her seat to a white man on a bus. Montgomery was one of the most racially divided cities in the South in those days. Blacks were wanting to riot, and whites were wanting to kill blacks who were wanting to riot. The black community elected a young father, a young preacher, a young seminary graduate, Martin Luther King Jr., to organize them to respond to the crisis. Over 2,000 people rallied in front of a church that night to decide what they would do. The air was tense and explosive. It was a dangerous night for both blacks and whites. Reverend Martin Luther King stood up to speak to them that night. And here are some of the words of what he said.
We are here this evening for serious business. We're here in a general sense because, first and foremost, we are American citizens, and we are determined to acquire our citizenship to the fullness of its meaning. We're here also because of our deep-seated belief that democracy transformed from thin paper to thick action is the greatest form of government on earth. But we are here in a specific sense because of the bus situation in Montgomery, and we are not wrong in what we are doing. If we are wrong, then the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. If we are wrong, Jesus of Nazareth was merely a utopian dreamer who never came down to earth. If we are wrong, justice is a lie. But in our protests, there will be no cross burnings. No white person will be taken from his home by a hooded Negro mob and brutally murdered. There will be no threats and intimidation. We will be guided by the highest principles of law and order, the deepest principles of our Christian faith. Love must be our regulating ideal. If we fail to do this, our protest will end up as a meaningless drama on the stage of history, and its memory will be shrouded with the ugly garments of shame. In spite of the mistreatment that we have confronted, we must not become bitter and end up hating our white brothers. Let no people pull you down so low as to make you hate them.
Instead of a riot, they organized a boycott of the Montgomery buses. Nonviolently, they brought the city to its knees. King and his movement became internationally famous after that. Together with Ralph Abernathy and others, they founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and began organizing voter registration throughout the South. At that time, less than 10% of blacks in America were registered to vote. And in most cases in the South, they were not allowed to register. In 1960, four black college students in Greensboro, North Carolina, went into a whites-only department store and tried to sit down at the lunch counter and be served. They were arrested, but they took it to court and a nationwide protest movement called sit-ins began. In October of that same year, Reverend King and several others joined a sit-in in Atlanta, Georgia, and demanded to be served food just like the white people. They too were arrested. Later, all were freed but King, who was found to be on parole for a traffic violation. And he was sentenced to 4 months of hard labor in the Reidsville State Prison, the harshest maximum security facility in the South. The reputation of Martin Luther King and the movement grew larger and larger. The turning point in his life and the life of the movement took place in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. Birmingham was arguably the most oppressive and thoroughly segregated city in the nation in those days. It had such a long history of brutality and violence against its black citizens that it was known by some as the American Johannesburg. The homes of the blacks in one section of town were bombed by whites so often it got the name Dynamite Hill. While there, he had been given a newspaper in which a number of white clergy, Christian and Jewish, had written a public letter criticizing him for pushing integration too quickly. He sat down in his cell, and on pieces of newspaper, rags, toilet tissue, and backs of envelopes, he wrote a public response. His response became known as the Letter from Birmingham Jail and has become one of the most famous statements about nonviolent civil disobedience written in this century. Here's a portion of what he said.
My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in Birmingham Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Since I feel that you are men of genuine goodwill and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. You are right when you note that we are outsiders coming into your community, that we have come to Birmingham because there is terrible injustice here and we must respond like the Apostle Paul did to the Macedonian call for help. Moreover, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects us all indirectly. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within its bounds. You also mentioned the demonstrations in Birmingham, which you deplored, but you did not mention the horrible conditions that made them necessary. The unsolved bombings, the killings, the whole ugly record of brutality that made Negro life here so grossly unjust. You advised us to negotiate our problems with the city fathers, something that we have frequently attempted to do, only to have them break their promises time and again. And in so many past experiences, our hopes have been blasted, and the shadow of deep disappointment settled upon us. We had no alternative except to prepare for direct action, whereby we would present our very bodies as a means of laying our case before the conscience of the local and the national community. He told us that our protests were untimely and that we should trust you and wait. For centuries, the Negro has heard wait, and wait has nearly always meant never. We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers and sisters smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find you tongue-twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, when you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigger, your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title of Mrs. When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments, when you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait.
On April 4th, 1968, King and Abernathy and several others spent most of their day in their room at the Lorraine Motel planning for the big events of the next few days. He met with some of the organizers of the march, trying to streamline events so that they would not get out of hand. He met with a group of violent black youths to see if they could talk them into laying down their clubs and rocks and working with him as nonviolent marshals of the parade, of the march. They refused. He met with Andrew Young, a United Church of Christ pastor and lawyer, who spent most of the day in court making arrangements so that the march would be considered a legal protest. He even took time to visit with his brother, A.D., who was visiting in town, and together they got on separate phones and called their mother. Around 5, they all began to change clothes and get ready for dinner. They were going to a home of a local pastor who had invited all of them over for dinner. A few moments before 6, the pastor arrived and people began to gather outside to leave. King stood at the doorway and yelled to Abernathy, "Are you ready?" Abernathy said, "Just let me put on some aftershave lotion." King said, "Okay, I'll be standing out here on the balcony." At 6:05 that evening, Martin Luther King, Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson, and several others were standing on the second floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, waiting to go to dinner. The car that was to drive them pulled up. He recognized the driver as Ben Branch, the young man who was going to sing for them after dinner, and he yelled, "Ben," he said, "make sure you play Precious Lord Take My Hand at the meeting tonight. Sing it real pretty." Ben yelled back, "Okay, Doc, I will." Just then, they heard the sound of a shot ringing out, the sound of a high-powered rifle. King slammed backwards against the wall of the balcony and then fell forward onto the balcony floor. Ralph Abernathy rushed out to him. Someone else found a pillow to put under his head. A Secret Service agent held a towel to the wound in his neck to try and stop the bleeding. Others were running up the stairs. Some were running for cover. Some were screaming. During the next few minutes, Ralph held the head of his dearest, closest friend in his lap while waiting for an ambulance to arrive and watching the life bleed out of him. He spoke to Martin several times during those minutes, but Martin could only respond with his eyes. Years later, Ralph said that he heard much from those eyes that night. Martin Luther King Jr. looked at him very awake and very alert, and with eyes he seemed to be speaking very clearly. He was saying, "Ralph, it isn't over. It's only in other people's hands now. Don't give up. Never give up. Never give up. Never give up." And then he died. As Greg read from the Gospel of John, and Nathaniel said, "What good can come out of Nazareth?" And Samuel, "Here I am, Lord. Here I am. Send me." How is God speaking to you? What good can come out of Grace United Church of Christ? Are we saying, "Here I am, send us"? Amen.